This is the second in consecutive sessions that I've been talking about humility. I spent a lot of time actually thinking about what I'm going to say today. What I didn't know was going to happen was what happened last week here, with what Elise led us through a session on, if I've got this right, yes, privilege. And as it was going on, I started thinking, well, hang on, this just flows. Sorry, I'm umming a lot this morning. I'll be all right. Different people would have taken different things away from last week's session. There's no doubt about that. For me, it was all felt a bit dark. I don't know if it did for other people here. I have a tendency to beat myself up. So talking about privilege, it immediately made me think, yes, well, we're all really privileged. I'm really privileged. I'm incredibly privileged. I was talking to Elise afterwards, and I suddenly remembered that nobody had mentioned the scariest verse in the Bible. If you happen to be a privileged person, which we all are, this is it. From everyone to whom much has been given, much will be required. From the one to whom much has been entrusted, even more will be demanded. Is that scary? Yes. So, and the context of that, I'm not going to go into the context in detail, but just before that, Jesus has quite clearly been saying that knowledge is important. If you know what's going on, then you've got a responsibility to do something about it. That's combining what Jesus said there with what he said elsewhere. But if you know what's going on, then you are more responsible. And if you don't realise that what you've done has affected somebody else badly, that's one thing. But if you do know, then you have a responsibility. And of course we do know. We live in a world where communication is just so incredible that we know what's going on the other side of the world. We know what's going on in Syria. We know that there are people starving in places like that. And here we are, privileged. Doesn't this sound exciting and fun so far? Yeah. This is going to be a joyful sermon. I've got the answer to these problems and I'm going to share them with you. We don't need to feel guilty. Ken? No, we can talk about it now. I don't mind. I'm going on a holiday in a few hours' time. Sorry?
With this verse, if what you're talking about is a finite supply of something that is finite.
Where did the microphone go? Oh, there it is. You're getting complicated. We need to get this on tape.
It's just that it's like if you're talking about things that are finite, then it might get scary because you feel like to give is to lose.
Yep.
If you're thinking about things like love, which are infinite, yes, then to give love is not to lose because it just seeps back up through the pores into the from the yes. source. And so there is no loss in giving love. I think we might interpret it as being scary because we're used to the idea that we build up our own little stash and to give is to lose. That's just a...
Yep.
Just take
okay.
on it.
Yeah, good. We're going to be talking. The answer to all of this is actually humble service. It doesn't matter how privileged you are. This is my thesis for today. This is my argument for today. It doesn't matter how privileged you are, or how poor you are. Whether you're a happy person or a sad person, none of that matters because we are called to humble service of God. And humble service is a joy and it's a privilege, or it should be. The position of a servant is actually very privileged. Servants are not responsible for managing stuff. They're not responsible for key performance indicators. They're not responsible for executive outcomes. That's the boss's job. That's the boss's problem. The servant is only required to have an ear, which is open to hear what the boss wants, and to get on with it. So it's an extremely privileged position to be a servant. And just another thought is that there is no connection between privilege and happiness. There is no connection between privilege and contentment. Just because you are more privileged doesn't mean that you're going to be more happy or more content. We will come back to some of that. Jesus said, we have this, you read a little bit of this out, yes. Come to me, all you that are weary and are carrying heavy burdens, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and humble in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. For my yoke is easy and my burden is light. The yoke is what oxen wear, but it's also a symbol of service. You take on somebody's yoke, you're taking on the role of them guiding you, them making the decisions. You are just entering service. So when Jesus talks about taking his yoke, he's talking about committing yourself to his service. Here's a thought. If Christians believe what Christians claim that they believe, i.e. one, that there is a God, two, that this God loves us, really loves his children, all his children, and loves us so much that he was, when we, through our own selfish acts, separated ourselves from him, he was prepared to do absolutely everything that was necessary to make reconciliation possible. That's what Christians believe. I hope there's no arguments about that. If we really believe that, is there any logical... the only logical response to that belief seems to me to be to say, okay, God, whatever you want, I'll do it. Humble service. This isn't the way most of us live. It's not the way I live, but it seems to me that is the logical way to respond to such a gracious, loving God. Keep that thought in your heads. We've just had three readings. Oh, we'll come back to that. When I talked about humility last time, I put up on the board just every single quote that I could come across quickly where Jesus talked about the importance of humility. You may notice that there are rather a lot of them. He talked about humility even more than he talked about prayer. And this is incredible because he talked about prayer a lot, and I'm always going on about that. I was astonished to find out how often he talked about humility. He said things like, you've got to humble yourselves and be like little children. Little children had no status in Jesus' day, none at all. He said you've got to be humble servants of each other. He also, and we'll come to this in a few minutes, he said, look, I've set this example of humility. And if you think of the idea that God came and lived on the earth as a human being in poverty, it is an incredible act of humility to take. And that's his example. He says, I want you to be like that. And it doesn't matter how privileged we are, how much money we've got, how much money we haven't got, we can live like that. Three of those references are the three readings that we've just had, and Bobby was absolutely right, there is a bit of a theme running through them. These are the three highlighted there in yellow, and I'm just going to go through them. I can't go through the whole thing, there just isn't time. I'm going to go through just to pick the eyes out of these, and hopefully everything will make sense. Sorry this is so dense, this particular, I'm just going to read it through quickly. Now, whenever you give alms, do not sound a trumpet before you. I don't need to. It's just been read a few minutes ago. Do you agree with me? Good. Okay, thank you. Most of you know that I spent most of the last four months or so of last year writing one assignment, which I had to complete to finish off my Masters of Divinity. I was writing on a particular passage in Matthew, which we're going to come to, is the third one that was read, the reading that Bobby did. So I wrote over 14,000 words on 12 verses in Matthew. In order to do that, I had to, because it's done at that level, which is totally ridiculous in terms of, never mind, I won't get started. I had to submit something called a project proposal. So I had to draw up a proposal for writing this assignment, and had to have it approved by an expert in the New Testament and also in Matthew. And, excuse me. So I sent off this project proposal, and eventually it came back and it said, yes, this was a perfectly acceptable project. And at one stage, I can remember his, I assume it's a hymn because he sounded so pompous, but I remember the exact words. They said, I assume that the student will take into account Matthew's use of parallelism and chiastic structure. This meant that I had to, in my assignment, take note of Matthew's use of parallelism and chiastic structure. So I went to my supervisor and I said, what the is parallelism and chiastic structure? And she said, go and look it up. But I had no idea. Honestly, I just didn't know. Now I do know a bit about that. And I put a whole section in there on parallelism and the chiastic structure. Of course I did. And I also talked about, what's it called? No, I can't remember. Some kind of syntax. Never mind, doesn't matter. Parallelism is looking at verses, looking when you're reading a verse and you find that there's repeated themes or repeated phrases, right? Now, if you look at this, you can see there are, I've divided it into two because he's talking about giving alms, giving to the poor in the top section and praying in the top section. But you see the first thing you come across, da-di-da-di-da, hypocrites. The second book you say hypocrites. Then in the top line it says they do this so that they may be praised by others. And in the bottom line it says, I could point this out to you. They may be praised by others. This one says so that they may be seen by others. And then he says, truly I tell you they've received their reward. Here, truly I tell you they've received their reward. And right at the end he says, do it in secret. Your Father who sees in secret will reward you. And when he's talking about prayer, shut the door, pray to your Father who is in secret. Your Father who sees in secret will reward you. So there's an awful lot of parallelism going in, on in there. Parallelism was used partly for a poetic sense, but also because a passage where that kind of parallelism is used is a passage which has been carefully thought through, and the author wants you to take careful note of it. So this is important stuff, and keep spotting that as we go through the other two, because that's important. But the key message of this is you don't do things in order to be seen or to be praised by others. You do them so that God will see what you're doing. And that's the important thing. We're going to do a quick... Have we got time? Yes, we do have lots of time. We're going to do a quick whiteboard exercise. I need a scribe. Ta-da! There's a scribe. Probably do three whiteboard exercises, but don't worry about where things get written, because this is all supposed to be jumbled together in the end. It's not clear delineation. What I want to, just for a few seconds, is get people just to say, what are the kind of things that we do here in us 21st century Western Christians, privileged people, what do we do to impress others? Go on, open your hearts out. What do we do to impress others? Luke, first off.
Material things like clothes, houses, cars.
Yes. You mean you buy your clothes to impress others? Is that what you're saying?
You may not
take that. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
We don't care.
Others? Yeah. Yeah. Sorry. Build big churches. I like that. Yes, we can feel smug about that, can't we? Yes. Hmm? On a hill.
Yes.
Build big churches on a hill. Yes. Okay. What else do we do to impress other people? Sorry. Titles. We're going to come back to that. That's part of the third session. Yes. Yeah.
Compete for numbers in churches.
Compete for numbers in churches. Yes. Ian. Selective social media posting. Hang on a second. Where did the microphone go? I just want you to expand on that.
So selective social media.
Oh, is it? I'm sorry. Hold the red button down.
To that better? Ooh. Selective social media posting. Effectively posting the good stuff without posting the raw stuff. Posting so you're showing how good your life is despite how actually underlying you might be in a real hole.
Right, yep, got that. Yeah.
That's social media, so like Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, those wonderful things.
I have to add there, though, that is assuming intention, that you are posting those things to impress people.
Yes, yes. John?
People with a trade or profession will use jargon that other people mightn't understand, but they do that to impress.
Yes, yeah, like parallelism and chiastic structures, yes, yeah. I do know what you mean, yes, yes, sorry. No, just, we'll get back to you. Yeah. Jenny?
In order to keep on being employed, you need to impress on your employers that you're doing a good job.
Yes. Elise, were you one, Karen? No. I'm just putting you in the queue. I wasn't sure whether you had put your hand up or not. Sorry.
Don't speak yet.
No, yeah, that's right. Don't speak yet.
Spend time Elise? contemplating how you're going to cook for the church lunch so everyone's enjoys, eats all your food and other food gets left.
But that's so important, isn't it? Yeah. Karen?
This is only a minor point, but when someone mentioned the social media postings, I would put in that same category those Christmas letters that people have been sending out for decades.
I've
never been able to put one together like the ones I receive.
Ronnie?
I think also tied into social media is like who you hang out with and who you've got pictures of you with and where you go and... So I'm hanging out with the cool crowd or whatever.
Yes.
Not that I am. Except for here, of course.
Yes. Tyson? Oh, all right. Claire, then Tyson. That sounds right. Yeah.
I think in response to the thing about the big churches and et cetera, we can have a great deal of smugness about how not big we are and how we rent a hall and how non-hierarchical we are and how great we are at being alternative.
Yeah.
I think our use of language indicates it very clearly, because if I sort of say, oh, I'm just a bum who stays at home and, you know, hangs out with my kids, that's one way of describing what I do. Or I could also say I'm an early childhood engineer, I educate, I'm a logistics technician, etc., etc. So I'm... So just our use of language, how we describe what we do... can be really powerful too.
Yeah. Here's something I was just thinking about: is my car is usually filthy. Why do we clean our cars? Is that to impress others? Why do we clean our houses? Huh? No, dirt's good for you. We should have more dirt in our lives. It's healthy for us. It builds up our immune system. Sorry. Yeah, cockroaches I draw the line at. Yes, fair enough. Okay, we'll move on. We'll move on to the second reading. This was... there's two versions of this story, and one of them, John and James's mother took them to Jesus and asked this question. And... You remember the story? It was just read to us just now. Yeah. On the other occasion, John and James, I think Mark records them as John and James came to Jesus, and it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. It's a slightly different story. But the point is that what they were asking was that when he came into his kingdom, they would be able to sit on his left and his right hand. This means that they were going to be number two and number three in the kingdom. And the other disciples, when they heard this, they got really irate. They got furious. Jesus, again, he's saying, this is what the world's like. You are not to be like that. This is what he's saying. So he's saying this: you know that the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them. Their great ones are tyrants over them. Will not be so among you. Whoever wishes to be great among you must be your servant. Whoever wishes to be first among you must be your slave. Just as the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve and to give his life a ransom for many. This is one of the occasions where Jesus actually pulled himself into the equation and said, this is why you've got to be humble servants of one another, because I'm setting that example. And if I do that, then you most certainly must do it. Again, he's contrasting the way the world works with the way he wants his followers to work. This is not new stuff. You actually find this right from Genesis right through. It's not new stuff. We are to be humble servants of one another. God wants the human race to love him and to love each other. And the whole sin is selfishness. Selfishness is sin. I've come to this conclusion this last year, I think, that it really is that simple. Sin is when you put your own needs, your own desires, or those of your own group above the needs of other people. God has always said that those who follow him should serve each other. He's always said that. Jesus is just saying it again and making it very, very clear. This isn't brand new stuff that he's introducing here. Are there any thoughts on that particularly that haven't come up there, John?
Just
hold on a second.
The version, the way the message version of the Bible interprets that, I thought was absolutely terrific for what we're going through. It says, so Jesus got them together to settle things down. He said, you've observed how godless rulers throw their weight around, how quickly little power goes to their heads. It's not going to be that way with you.
Yes, yes. Can I comment? Yeah, sure.
I was really struck today with hearing that aloud afresh, those two statements, and just the thought being, how have we managed to evade the power of that criticism in the church, in my life, and in society? So it was sort of the raw power of hearing Jesus get stuck into the Sadducees. So it's the raw power of that. But also the gratitude for that gospel and how in its day and now it is so radically refreshing and challenging. And so how grateful, I mean, let's face it, there's lots of the church that doesn't practice it. And yet we have the constant witness of Quakers. You know, there's such a witness of it being transformational of the church and of society through history as well, that I'm grateful for.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and I just thought of one example in my field of management. You know, in the 50s, a guy called Robert Greenleaf came out with a major textbook that's still referred to in leadership called Servant Leadership. And that's still, it's still out there and people still are challenged by it. So I guess gratitude that we are part of this tradition.
Yep. I'd just like to add to that because I think while I was doing this, I was thinking about what makes a good boss, which isn't actually part of the thing, but thinking about, I've spent years and years in bureaucracies, and I've had bosses who I thought were good and bosses who I didn't think were good. And it seems very similar to something I've thought before about what makes a good teacher. A good boss is actually focused on the needs of the person who's working for them. That's how they get the best out of them. They're focused. They listen to them. They regard them as being equal in terms of contributing to what's going on. A bad boss just says, "You do this." Sorry, a bad boss just says, "Just do you do this." That's you do what I tell you. Why? Because I'm your boss. This is very much what that's all about. Yes. Anyone else? Paul? Other Paul?
Yeah, just agreeing with thinking about what Michael was saying, that I spent a long time not going to church because I didn't like the bits that this says not to do in my town and community. And I found Karen and you guys, and I'm not going to keep writhing in guilt anymore, you know. I think there are many, many good people, and one thing we're really good at is beating ourselves up over still not being good enough.
Yep.
You know, but this is a tremendous thing to be repeating all the time on the larger scale in the world, because it's what happens. People, through their skill and ability, become put in positions of responsibility, and then they blow it.
Yep.
It's the history of the world. So in the big picture, very important, also important that we don't keep beating ourselves up, because the good people keep taking responsibility for the stuff that other people do.
Doing well. We'll move on to the third reading. This is actually the passage that I did my dissertation on. So I wrote the 14,000 words on this very passage. And I thought that probably 14,000 words would be roughly one sermon a month for the entire year. But then part of the time I'd have to be talking about parallelism and chiastic structures, and I don't think you'd really enjoy that. Jesus is talking to the crowds and the disciples in this passage, and he's talking about the scribes and the Pharisees when he starts off. He says, they do all their deeds to be seen by others. They make their phylacteries broad and their fringes long. Phylacteries are little boxes. I'm sure most of you know this, that people, that Orthodox Jews strap to their arms and to their foreheads, and they contained little passages of scripture. And their purpose was so that the person who was wearing them would remember those scriptures. That was what the purpose was for. And the same thing with the tassels. I can't remember the exact details of the tassels, but they were a reminder to the person who was wearing them of what God expected from them all the time. The idea, he's saying, these people make their phylacteries really big and their tassels really long, and they're actually trying to impress others with this. They're saying, oh, look how holy I am, is the message they're sending by doing this. They love to have the place of honour at banquets and the best seats in the synagogues and to be greeted with respect in the marketplaces and to have people call them rabbi. But you, if you're following me, you are not to be called rabbi. You have one teacher and you are all brothers. You may notice when Bobby read that from the NRSV, it says students. The actual Greek word there is definitely brothers, but there is a tendency these days, which I'm still not entirely happy about, to make terms generic. The brothers and sisters is the way these things will often be translated. But this particular word, if you just translated it brothers and sisters, you'd actually lose the sense of what Jesus is saying. Equals would probably be a better word. You are not to be called rabbi. If you have one teacher, you are all brothers. One teacher is Jesus. The rest of you are down there, and you are all equal. Call no one on earth your father, for you have one father, the one in heaven, nor are you to be called instructors, for you have one instructor, the Messiah. The word instructor there is a little bit clumsy. That is actually what I was writing the entire thesis about, was that one word, which in Greek is kathegetes, I'm going to get boring, and is not used anywhere else in Scripture. No Greek version of it has that particular word there, and this got me all excited. And mainly got to be excited because if you translate that as teacher, which is a perfectly acceptable way of translating it, it says, you have one teacher, the Messiah. Matthew has already made it very clear that Jesus is the Messiah. And when I read that 20 years ago, turned my life upside down. Jesus is our one teacher, I said to myself. Good grief, suppose he meant it, that Jesus is to be our only teacher. And that particular verse has continued to turn my life upside down, and that's why I wanted to write on it. So the greatest among you will be your servant. All who exalt themselves will be humbled. All who humble themselves will be exalted. What this passage is really about is taking titles. I think it's a really interesting topic, because obviously within churches there's lots of people with titles. You don't have to have them, but they exist. Is this necessarily a bad thing? I suspect it's not. For example, when Jesus says, "Don't let anyone call you teacher," teacher can be just a description of what you do. You know, there's nothing wrong with that. To say, "What do you do?" Oh, I'm a teacher. What he's talking about is somebody, as happened in his day. The word rabbi basically means teacher. Is somebody coming up to you and saying, "Oh, teacher." You know, you have this status up there because of what you do. Lots of cultures today, a teacher is somebody who has very high status. And you wouldn't argue with a teacher. When I used to work with refugee communities, I regularly came across that problem of a family from, say, Vietnam, who were unhappy with their child going to school and coming back and saying, oh, we did social something or other. Today, and they want them to be learning the kind of stuff that's going to get them a good career. And I said, well, have you talked to the teacher about it? Oh, no, we couldn't talk to the teacher about it. You know, the teacher has that status as far as we're concerned. We couldn't possibly criticise what the teacher does. We're just very unhappy with it. Yes. So it's about not taking titles. I think it's just an example of how far the church has gone away. I mean, going back to Constantine's day, very quickly the rot set in. When the church became institutionalized, bishoprics, rather than being people who were good bosses who cared for the souls and the welfare of the people in their care, they became positions of power. And once they and money. And once they became positions of power and money, people who wanted them wanted those positions of power and money, who had absolutely no interest in the spiritual welfare of the people who they were being looked after. Any thoughts on this? John? Hold on a second. Hold on a second.
You objected to substituting brothers, putting brothers and sisters, I think, instead of brothers. It's Would you object to siblings?
Yeah, I don't think siblings would carry the meaning either in this case. It's not a very commonly used word, and I don't want to see words put in there which people have to look up a dictionary afterwards. But the message in that particular bit is you have one teacher and you are all the same. You are all equals, is what he seems to be trying to get across. Siblings would take it somewhere else. The thing is, though, I spent months studying this, but you might find this interesting. He goes to a family reference at that point. You are not to be called rabbi, which is not a family reference, that's just teacher, for you have one teacher, you are all brothers. He then says, and no, call no one on earth your father. So he's sticking with the family reference there. You have one father, the one in heaven. I've got another 14,000 words to go on that.
Yeah, I guess you've got me thinking about the question, though, because brothers is family, and families in this tradition would have been highly looking at each other and serving each other and excluding others.
Yeah.
Like, that's the point of that collectivist society, is that you look after your own and other. And it's almost like he's calling on that. So how do we reconcile that?
Yes, I'm not quite sure I'm with you. Sorry. Lyndon?
I actually wasn't going to talk about the equality, but the humility bit. I actually came face to face on a holiday with my lack of humility. Michael and I ended up in the immigration queue to get out of Malaysia, and it was horrendously long, and we were one of very few Westerners in the queue. And I said to Michael, half jokingly, they need a queue now for entitled Westerners, because we do get that feeling. You know, the developing world has in many cases developed. The Chinese are travelling, the Koreans are travelling. There's so many people travelling now who didn't before. And we encountered this in Nepal as well. And I think we're sheltered a bit from here. We have had generations of feeling entitled without realising, you know, that position that we give. And there's this sort of feeling when you're in a queue like that, that somehow you should be further up the queue, you know, the business class queue. I think this is actually going to be something, and I think this is part of what's going on politically too, that those of us who have been entitled for generations, this is now the rest of the world saying enough. Your era of entitlement is over. This is going to change, and it challenges each one of us at a very personal level and to the core, assumptions that we have operated on about our place in the world. And I think it's really easy to talk about how other people ought to be humble, but when you confront your own inner arrogance that's kind of hidden there, I think we're in for a generation of illumination on this one.
Yes, good say. Elise, can I just come back again to that, the use of that word brothers? I've got two concerns about changing words in the Bible. One is that you're actually changing the word. You're taking something which is written in the Bible, and you're saying, okay, well, we're going to take that word out and we're going to substitute another word because it may be less offensive. I think that's very dangerous, because people who just read their Bibles in English may say, well, that's what it was. The other thing is that it gives a completely false impression of what society was like at that time. Society, that, like, sexist just isn't the word. That's why you've got words like that there. And if you start saying, oh, Jesus said brothers and sisters, then it's starting to give a portrayal of his world which is completely false. So these are the concerns that I have about it. Yeah.
Peter, can I just make a brief comment about that very thing?
Wait, yeah, sorry, go on.
What I see them doing linguistically is he's moving between the teacher-student, teacher-disciple metaphor and the family metaphor. So that's why that I think gets a bit confusing, but I think we need to play with both. So to change it to siblings, I mean, to me, he's got rabbi, teacher, rabbi, disciple. That he's playing with that metaphor. Yep. I think that's why it gets a bit mixed.
Yes, yes. The other thing about the word father there, if you're a bit confused about that, in that time, calling somebody father, if they weren't your physical father, was a sign of very great respect.
Yes.
And it would normally only be used by somebody who was, what's the word, the patron, what's the other word?
Patron,
and who's the person who has a patron?
Client.
Yeah, that's good. Patron-client relationship. Yeah. So it would be common for a young man who wanted to get on in the world to have a patron.
Yes.
And he might well refer to his patron as father.
Yes.
So that's the kind of thing. It's respectful titles that Jesus is talking about here.
Just a personal example of this issue about titles. I've gotten rather used to being able to ring up people and introduce myself and say I'm the course coordinator at Curtin University, and they're usually pretty respectful and respond and are very helpful. And I can't do that anymore. And when I rang up somebody last week and had to introduce myself, it was a bit of a realisation that, oh, I've lost my title. a bit humbling.
Yeah, welcome to the wonderful world of humility. It's great. Yes,
Peter, given you've studied this, tell us about who he was talking to, and they were a bunch of blokes, that he might have actually been giving some instruction to a specific group of people at a specific time in history, and that maybe that when we read him, his instructions to a specific group of men, we might be reading too much in it to say that that's a message to us, and that he wasn't actually trying to take apart the rabbinic structure of his culture.
Mm. He wasn't talking to a bunch of blokes. In this specific case, Matthew makes it very clear that he was talking to the crowds and the disciples. So there would have been women there too. But there's a parallel passage in Mark which doesn't put it quite like that. It's one of these situations where the truth is we don't know what the truth is. Yes, definitely, yeah. And one of the important things is that he had been talking to the scribes and the Pharisees and giving them a right old earful. He then has this little passage where it says he talks to the crowds and the disciples. The inference is that the scribes and the Pharisees are still there and still listening, because after this he goes into what are known as the seven woes, where he really gets stuck into them. Yeah, but I'm sorry, that's... Yeah, one. This will be the last one because I'm getting the wind-up from Marita.
Just one comment. I noticed that when I'm working with patients, it's the constant thing of, I'm not a teacher anymore, I'm not a doctor anymore, I'm not a whatever I am anymore, I've lost all my titles. Who am I as I sit here with my cancer, or who as I'm dying? And I think this is the thing, you know, that comment you said about who is the teacher? Jesus is the only teacher, because in that situation when everything looks like it's been taken away from us, the only thing that really feeds us is the fact that we are loved in God, and nothing can separate us from that. And that's the lesson I learn every day at the hospital. Every time I get caught up in all the crap of, you know, trying to impress people, I think, yeah, let it go. This is what matters. Yeah. So,
thank you. Good.